The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
It's Culture Club time, and we're delighted to have Sinead Crowley with us, somebody who you would know well from television over the years as RT's arts and culture correspondent. She's left that now. She has another job, but she is writing more novels, and her latest novel is A Maid on Fifth Avenue. Sinead, congratulations on its publication. What's the book all about?
Thank you very much. A Maid on Fifth Avenue, I'm calling it a historical mystery. So there's two timelines in it, two women. There's Annie, who's in Kerry, kind of around the 1920s, and she's in West Kerry, out in the Dingle direction, and she is somebody who knows there's another world out there. She's grown up in West Kerry, but she's looking out at the ocean thinking, there's another life out there and I'd like to experience it. And she heads off to be a maid on Fifth Avenue. But she hasn't completely left Ireland behind, so something happens to draw her home. And then in 2022, we have another young woman called Emer, who's an Irish woman living in LA, working as a video editor. But just after COVID, she's absolutely exhausted. She's kind of sick of staring into a screen. So she comes home to the family holiday home in West Kerry. And at the very beginning of the book, bones are discovered underneath a fairy tree. So you find out over the rest of the book what connects the two women and indeed who owns the bones.
Okay, where did the inspiration for the story come from?
Lots of inspiration, but my grandmother was actually a maid on Fifth Avenue.
Oh.
So she left Ireland in the 1910s, a little bit before this book takes place, and was a maid. Now, obviously, she came home. The rest of the story isn't hers, and I have to keep saying that because there are bones and it's a mystery and all that, so there isn't that much drama in my family. But she was a maid on Fifth Avenue and came home, and that fascinated me, the idea of coming back. You know, we read so much about people emigrating and going to find a new world. But I kept thinking, imagine living in New York in the Gatsby era, you know, in the jazz age and electricity and music and coming back to rural Ireland and what would happen there. So that's what kind of inspired her, just that idea of somebody going, but also somebody coming back. And then obviously in the case of this book, she has to come back. She's pulled back by a mystery.
You spent years as RT's arts and culture correspondent. How much of that time was spent wishing that you'd be the person been interviewed about your work?
Well, it goes way back. I mean, I think since I was about 5 or 6, since whenever I was learning how to write in school, I wanted to write books. So it goes back even before I worked for RTE. But I actually think working for RTE helped in that, no more than yourself, you meet a lot of authors. And you kind of realise they're real people, you know, whereas if you're a reader, you think that authors are sitting there in the garret and they're divinely inspired. But actually, when you interview them, they're like the rest. You know, there's some are chatty and some aren't, and some have different ways of working and some don't. And I met people who were able to do it alongside with a day job and that. So I think it kind of demystified.
Which is what you've had to do, because you're not as yet a full-time writer.
No. And actually, I think that's worked out OK. I mean, you think the dream is to be a full-time author, but the older I get and the more I write, there's a comfort in it not being your day job. You know, I have some friends who write full time and they have to produce the book a year, or they might feel compelled to write in a certain way, or they're looking for the TV deal. Where I suppose I have the comfort of it doesn't pay the mortgage, essentially. You know, I do have a day job. And so when I write, I can write exactly what I want.
You know? Might you get the TV deal out of this book, though?
I believe historical fiction is dreadful for TV deals, so I've gone the wrong direction. I'm told it'd be very expensive, you see, because you'd have to recreate New York in the 1920s. So I should have written it all in 2022. So that's what I'm told. I don't know. But, you know, my phone will be on as soon as this interview is over.
Let's go to your Culture Club choices, and let's start with the first piece of music that you ever remember buying. Was it a single for you?
It was a single. I can still see the old record player at home, a big, massive, heavy thing that you had to, open up the lid and figure out how to use it. So the first single was more than likely Karma Chameleon by Culture Club, which I didn't even know were we able to pronounce it, but it was huge. And coming back, you know, preparing for this interview, I was thinking about it, and I think there might have been a bit of a journalist in me even then, because it wasn't just the music. Boy George was huge. And the story around him, and who was he? And, you know, the coverage at the time, people would be horrified now at the coverage, but the coverage of who was this guy and why was he wearing a dress and why did he have long hair? And people were fascinated by him, you know, so we all kind of...
And here in Ireland, the fact he was Irish, essentially. Yeah. Well, he was born in England to Irish parents from Tipperary,
huge.
I think, wasn't
so
it?
So they were called O'Dowd, and I believe there was a link to Thurles, and there was a big kerfuffle at the time, would there be a civic reception for him back home in Thurles?
Or would he play the Fela?
Yeah, there was some, you know, people, should he be invited or not? And at the time, I suppose there weren't that many Irish people making it big. Do you know what I mean? This is pre-1990, so it was the mid-80s. And just this idea that this guy was famous all over the world and he had relatives in Thurles. And I went to fancy dress party, I remember, one year, a summer thing at a festival down in Wexford with my cousins. And I'd say there was seven Boy Georges. It was all anybody was talking about.
Let's hear a bit of Karma Chameleon. Nearly 40 years on, it remains a really good pop song, doesn't it?
I'd argue it's their second best song. They had a song called Victims on Now That's What I Call Music, either one or two, that I heard the other day that I would argue was slightly better, but he had a great voice.
He had.
Fantastic voice. Yeah.
Now, when it comes to favourite band or album or gig, you have a number of choices that sort of follow after your overwhelming almost love for U2. Why is that? What got you into U2 and why have you maintained your affection for U2?
I think when some of my friends heard I was doing this, I think they thought, oh God, she's not just going to talk about U2 for a half an hour. I'm not, I promise. But I did go to see that famous gig in 1987, Joshua Tree in Croke Park. And I know a lot of people mention it as their first gig, either that or the 1985 one. But I was lucky enough to get a ticket in 1987. I was very young, I was 13, but some older people on the road brought me along. And I hadn't a clue about live music or, you know, gigs or festivals or anything really. And I think when I look back, Ireland was pretty grim. You know, Dublin was pretty grim. Everyone kind of dressed in grey, you know, and there was talk of emigration and...
Not just talk of it, so many people in that era did emigrate.
That's true, you know. So I was younger than that. I was in second year in secondary school. But suddenly there was just this bit of light in the middle of the summer that everybody was talking about. This massive band were playing a gig and they were Irish and they were young. And there was a sense.
I'm sorry, they were successful internationally, getting back to the point you made earlier, but there's a lot of pride taken in them by getting on the cover of Time magazine, which was a thing at the time.
Absolutely. I remember Fergal Sharkey being on the front page of the Evening Press because he got to number one in England. Like, this was huge if somebody made it big abroad and then in America. So I was lucky enough to go to the gig and just was transported. It was an extraordinary day. I mean, you had, I think, the Pretenders and various people. We went at 12 o'clock in the day. Like, there was none of this turning up at 7:05 for the main act. We went at 12 o'clock and stayed until 11 o'clock.
Well, as a 13-year-old, you weren't drinking either, presumably.
No, I can't. I mean, would I let my own 13-year-old? No. But my parents didn't have a clue, I don't think. I can't even remember eating or drinking. Like, I doubt if there was even ladies' toilets in Croke Park in 1987. They certainly weren't fantastic. But we stayed all day, chatted to people, watched all the music. And then the band came out on stage and you were just absolutely transported. And what it did was it set off this love of live music in me and love of performance and this love of the arts. But this sense, because they were Irish, that they could get there from here, you know. And just in the weeks afterwards, I was still on an absolute high from watching and I loved the music, but also this sense of they did it. And I knew I wanted to be involved and I wasn't going to be a rock star, right? But I kind of knew I wanted to be vaguely involved in that world, whether it was through promotion or writing. I also wanted to be a writer and I loved long form journalism and I loved hot press and, you know, all those things. And I just thought on some level, I'm going to be connected with this world. I want to replicate or recreate what I've seen today. So it did the two things that day, an absolute love of U2 that I still have, still love their music, but also this sense of I want to be, however peripherally, involved in the arts world, whether through writing or not.
Let's hear a little bit of U2 live from 1987. I don't know if this is Croke Park or somewhere else, but this is one of the iconic U2 tracks, With or Without You. How many times have you seen you two live?
I was trying to count. Not that many. I'm not one of the, like, you know, mad fanatics. I'd say about 17 or 18. Not that many. I haven't travelled until recently, so I only ever saw them kind of when they played here. I saw them in Prague once by accident. We were on holiday anyway, and we went to see them in the Czech Republic.
Did you see them in Vegas?
I did go to Vegas.
That's how did you find that? Because that's visually overwhelming to the point is the music almost a side effect to the visual show?
It wasn't. It was really clever. So just in terms of I hopped off to Vegas, they very kindly organised it to coincide with my 50th birthday, which was nice of them. So I was able to persuade some very good friends to go to Vegas with me. It was an extraordinary show. But what they did was, which was really clever, the visuals are outstanding in the Sphere. But then in the middle of the gig, they brought it right back down to a kind of an acoustic set with just the band members. And that meant you were just on the cusp of being overstimulated. And then suddenly you were back down again and enjoying the gig. And actually, the visuals and the sound made it feel like you were in Vicar Street. That's how intimate it made it. So I was in a slightly different seat from my friends. I was up close to the band, so I was watching the band. They were kind of way back up in the spherical bit of the Sphere, so to speak. But seeing their videos afterwards, they got the same experience as me because the sound was so good. Like, you could whisper into the microphone and you could hear it way up the back. So in terms of a show, it was groundbreaking.
Yeah, Gavin Friday did this Culture Club last year. And what he said was that of all the venues that they've played in the States, it was the best, not because of the visuals, which he was involved in. He just said the sound. The sound was the best. Because normally they play in stadiums, which aren't necessarily the best. So they also, as well as best gig, they're your favourite band. Is there a favourite album?
The debate coming in here, my favourite album, I'm going to go actually for Octung Baby, given the Sphere link as well. I think most G2 fans debate Joshua Tree or Octung Baby, up, down and backwards. But Octung Baby is a fabulous album. I suppose the groundbreaking one, the one where they broke the link. They could have gone off and done Joshua Tree too, but they didn't. They went off and did something completely different. And a plug as well for a book, actually, if there's any fans listening. There's a book by Bill Flanagan called U2 at the End of the World, which is one of the best rock books I've ever read. And so if you're looking to kind of recreate that era or find out about it, I'd recommend that too.
What about Bono's own book, which I thought was highly enjoyable? And did you see his one-man show effectively around that book, which actually I would say was nearly better than any U2 gig I've been at?
I did. I was very lucky to interview him actually around the time of the book. So read it. I thought it was fantastic. Now, I didn't put it in my favourite books here because then I'd only be talking about one band. But I thought it was really good. The audiobook is great, actually, if people are into audiobooks, because he reads it so well and he kind of performs it. And produced as an audiobook, the sound and the, you know, if he's in the kitchen, you can hear the kettle whistling and the toaster popping and everything. So it's beautifully produced as an audiobook. And I was lucky enough to see him in the Olympia, which I think they're going to release. Or there was talk of them maybe releasing that.
I think it's actually filmed specially on Broadway. Mm. And it was supposed to be out on Apple TV this summer and hasn't come out as yet, my understanding. So maybe it's coming out before Christmas. Don't make it all about U2. There must be other favourite musicians, bands, whatever to mention.
Yeah, absolutely. But to go back to kind of the 80s and 90s, what it did then was, after going to Croke Park and loving it, was I just fell in love with going to live music. And Dublin was hopping. I mean, it was such a good place to be at the time, late 80s, early 90s. So we had the Bag It In and we had McGonagall's, and there was a band on every street corner, you know. So we loved Something Happens, Aslan, A House. I'm from Walkinstown originally, so A House were from up the road, and Power of Dreams, Aslan, of course. We just went to so many live gigs, and you kind of knew somebody or were vaguely aware of them, and they were just, it was what we did.
Do you still go to gigs?
Still go as often as I can, yeah. Particularly, you know, there was a bit of a lull when the kids were very small, but now they're getting older. So just in the last couple of weeks or in the last couple of months, I saw CMAT in Fairview Park, who is constantly on my Spotify now as opposed to my CD player. But I just think she's amazing, and that was terrific. And I actually saw her again in Electric Picnic a couple of weeks after that. And I went to see Cathal Kinnick the other night in Whelan's, who I don't think has played Dublin for about 15 years. And it was the loveliest night in Whelan's because it was everybody who used to go to Whelan's in about 1993 in the same room. So that was really gorgeous. And I go to see Something Happens every Christmas when they play Whelan's as well. So I suppose a combination of the old and the new.
Let's get into movies for next, OK? And you've two that you wanted to pull out in particular. On Colleen Kuhn is one. Why so?
Oh, I mean, for anyone who's seen it, it's just such a work of art. And I speak Irish, and I grew up with a mother who spoke Irish. And there wasn't a huge amount of, you know, books or material around when I was growing up in terms of, or you had to kind of seek it out, you know. But the next thing, in the last then, obviously 10, 20 years, suddenly we have good material in Irish. We have TV shows, we have films and so on. And then this film came along and I was very lucky to follow on Colleen Kuhn from its early days, because I was still working for RT at that stage. So I would have interviewed Cullum and Cleona, and kind of you were hearing from film critics that this was going to be big and the buzz was growing over it. And, you know, when you hear so much about something, you think, God, is it going to be as good now when I see it? Is it going to live up to it? But in fact, it was better. You know, it's an absolute work of art. And I love talking to Cullum about it, to Cullum Bure, the director, because he takes it so seriously as a piece of art. I think sometimes as Irish people, and I do so myself, you can kind of say, ah, sure, it's grand, you know, but I think he realises he made something really special. And the fact that it has travelled internationally, it's not just loved by people who speak Irish or loved by people who like Irish film. It has been shown all over the world, shown to people who aren't even aware that there is an Irish language. And it's just so simple and so beautiful. And I'm just so pleased that it got so far, you know, that it got as far as the Oscars. I think we all felt a little sense of ownership about it.
Your other movie is entirely different, though. Four Weddings and a Funeral.
That, put that in context, right? So I'll give you the context. When I was in, I did communications in DCU, and when I was in third year, I got a really lovely job, which was film reviewing for the Northside People, which was probably one of the happiest things I've done in work. Can you imagine being in third year in college and actually getting a job as a film reviewer? So slipping off the odd morning and going into the Savoy and just, you know, the empty cinema or the three or four kind of well-established film critics and me with my notebook. So loved that time anyway, of a soft spot for all the films I reviewed. But because I wasn't part of that film critic circle, I didn't know what was coming up. I could only go and see what was coming out on a Thursday because I only had one morning off college. And I turned up one morning and the place was packed and I couldn't understand what was going on. And it was Four Weddings and a Funeral. So first, it was great fun and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But also there was, again, that sense of, God, I'm sort of in at the beginning here on something, you know, and this is really good. And again, just sparked off this thing. This is what I want to do for a living. I want to write about this. I want to experience it.
We have a clip. And this clip from Four Weddings and a Funeral, Father Gerald, played by Rowan Atkinson, officiates his first ever wedding for Bernard and Lydia, played by David Haig and Sophie Thompson.
Repeat after me. I do solemnly declare.
I do solemnly declare.
That I know not of any lawful impediment.
That I know not of any lawful impediment.
Why I, Lydia Jane Hibbert.
Why I, Lydia Jane Hibbert.
May not be joined in matrimony.
May not be joined in matrimony.
To Bernard Geoffrey Sigil Delaney.
To Bernard Geoffrey Sigil Delaney.
I call upon those persons here present to witness.
I call upon those persons here present to witness.
That I, Bernard Delaney.
That I, Bernard Delaney.
Do take thee, Lydia Jane Hibbert.
Do take thee, Lydia Jane Hibbert.
To be my awful wedded wife.
To be my lawful wedded wife.
That's right. That's right. May Almighty God bless you all, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spigot. Spirit.
Bravo!
Bravo! Bravo! Four Weddings and a Funeral. We asked for a play, theatre, or musical, and apparently musicals are your thing.
Yeah, from, again, very early days. I remember being lucky enough to see an original Blood Brothers. I Googled it today, probably like 1986 or something in the Olympia. Brian Murray was in it, so you're going back that far. And my mother loved musicals as well, and she went to see it with some friends and then said I had to go and see it. So I went off with my cousin, and that kind of a lifelong love of musicals since then. You know, that feeling that you go to see a musical and the music is still in your head as you're leaving, going home on the bus. So one I saw then very recently, I'm actually going to see Hamilton this weekend, so I might have a completely different answer.
I was at Hamilton last Friday night, second time I've seen it. It was even better the second time, and I don't particularly like musicals. Mm. It's wonderful.
Can't wait. I'm going to see it on Friday. But in the meantime, the last really good musical I saw was called Fun Home, and it was at the Gate Theatre about a year ago. And Alison Bechdel, you know, who's famous, you've heard people talking about the Bechdel test in film, two women. Are they talking to each other without mentioning a man once? So she's a cartoonist from the States who grew up in the States and knew she was gay but had to come out as a teenager. And then they grew up in a funeral home as well, so that relationship with her parents. And it was made into a graphic novel, and then it was subsequently made into a musical, and it came to the Gate last year. Absolutely great fun. Very weighty themes, and it's not for kids. But it did absolutely also fulfil the test that as I went home, I put Spotify on the headphones and listened to it all the way home. So,
books, what author have you opted for?
Gone for a couple. I had to pick crime fiction because I love crime fiction and I write crime fiction. I was afraid to pick any Irish authors because I defend somebody. So I've gone for Laura Lippman.
Who's Laura Lippman?
Laura Lippman is based in Baltimore in Maryland, and she must have written, I'd say, about 20, 25 books at this stage. I love her because she has both series fiction with a private investigator called Tess Monahan, and she also writes standalone psychological thrillers. And they're just fantastic. I used to buy my books in a bookshop called Murder, Inc., which I think was in Dawson Street in Dublin City Centre, back in the days before Amazon, when you had to go into a shop and there was this fabulous crime-only bookshop, and you went in and the staff kind of all knew their stuff. And so I discovered Laura Lippman then, and you used to get the lovely American editions, you know, so I still have them all at home. But she's still writing and writes terrific standalone books as well. And what I like about her is every book is different. You know, the standalone books, she doesn't seem to be constrained by I have to write this or I have to write that. It's, you know, it's the story and the plot and the characters at the back of it.
You love music journalism as well, though.
Mm. That's the thing. I love music biographies, and I also like books written by music journalists. And one of the best I've read in recent years is called I'm Not With the Band by Sylvia Patterson. And I grew up reading Smash Hits, and like Smash Hits had their own language. You know, people who read Smash Hits can speak to each other in this kind of shorthand. And she was a magazine writer in that era of the 80s in Britain when really talented people wrote for magazines. Like magazines was where it was at in terms of cultural writing. And do you remember Smash Hits used to go off and interview politicians? Like there was a Margaret Thatcher interview and everything. So on the one level, they were talking to, you know, kids and teenagers, but they really had their eye on popular culture too. And it was a golden age of writing. And she writes about writing for Smash Hits, and it's just fantastic. So a combination of both, you know, travelling with bands and interviewing bands, and then of also actually taking down song lyrics and doing everything else Smash Hits used to do. But it's a gorgeous look into an era before social media, where the only time a band could communicate with their listeners was through magazines or through interviews. Whereas now they can just start their own TikTok or Instagram. But, you know, back in that day, you had to let the journalist in and be, they spent days with them, you know. So it's a fabulous book.
And your favourite biography, Bob Geldof's, is that it?
Yeah, I really love that book. I remember reading it obviously at the time, and then I've read it, you know, a couple of times since. And there's just so much in that book, because you have this great story of growing up in Ireland in the 70s, particularly, you know, difficult childhood of being a musician, of trying to make your way as a musician. And then it turns into this book about the making of Live Aid. And again, I suppose not just about Live Aid on stage, but the wheeling and the dealing behind the scenes and who he had to talk to and what he had to do. It's just a phenomenal book. I'm not sure he's written books about Africa, but I'm not sure if he's ever written another volume, because obviously his life took many turns since then. But that's his life from birth up until, I guess, just after Live Aid, around about 87, 88.
It certainly was not it, given what happened to him afterwards. No. Television, you've picked one from childhood, which I remember, but I don't think anyone else has nominated. The Hardy Boys, which would have been, if I remember rightly, Parker Stevenson and Sean Cassidy.
Absolutely. Sean Cassidy, I particularly remember.
David Cassidy's younger brother, wasn't it?
That's right. I'd sing the theme tune if I had to. It was on RTE early in the morning. And it was on over Christmas every morning, I remember. So I'd say you're talking 82. And
it was from the 70s, though. Those were reruns, because I remember from the 70s, because I'd read all the books before it came along as a TV show.
And Nancy Drew. So they obviously re-showed it again in the early 80s. And I'll tell you specifically why I know that, because I used to get up every morning and they showed it at about 10 o'clock in the morning on the Christmas holidays. And you know that Christmas holidays when you're a kid and you completely forget what day of the week it is, and I'd get up and I'd watch The Hardy Boys, and I saw about five or six episodes of it, and there was a mystery every week, and you know, absolutely loved it. And then I had to go back to school, and I was heartbroken. And then it was 1982, so we got up the next morning and it had snowed, and I got another 2 weeks off school, so I was able to watch the rest of the Hardy Boys. But leaving that aside, I suppose, look, the crime fiction and the mystery and this idea of a mystery being solved in every episode, absolutely loved it.
Which brings us to your adult choice. Mm. And you've gone for one again that hasn't been brought up previously, Elementary, which was the Sherlock Holmes remake with Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu.
That's right. And the reason for that was actually funny. I'm only putting it together in my head now. The snow kept us at home in 82. COVID kept us at home in 2020. And I have two sons. And I kept explaining to them that when I was young, everybody watched the one thing on television, because obviously everyone is sitting with different screens now. But we were all stuck at home during COVID, and, you know, school was on the screen and we had to let them communicate with their friends on screens and everything else. And I was searching around for something that we could all watch. And I was saying to them, you know, when I was young, we used to watch Little House on the Prairie or whatever. And they were just looking at me. So I came across this, and it is a remake of Sherlock. Really well done, though. I mean, they're very faithful to the story, other that Dr. Watson is a woman. But Sherlock has an addiction issue. So she's his sober companion and she comes to stay with him and then gets drawn into his world as a private investigator. But it fulfilled that thing of being both a long running story and then having a murder or a crime in every single episode. So it was just this lovely kind of hour at the end of the day where we could all sit down and watch the one episode. And it fulfilled that thing I wanted to have, having, you know, just a little compact thing that we could all put down the individual screens and actually watch something and enjoy it.
Do you have time for podcasts?
I do.
Quickly now, because we're coming near the end of our time. You understand that, being in the business.
Absolutely love all my news podcasts, obviously, at the moment, and all the American ones and the news agents and the rest is politics and all that. But a little word for one, given that I guess people listening to this show probably like writing and publishing and everything else. There's a podcast called The Publishing Rodeo, which I will recommend to people who are published and are established writers. It's not for people who want to get into writing or want to write a book. It's not a how to write a book. It's an in-depth look at the publishing business, which is very different from the writing business. Writing is great fun. Publishing is a business which you need to know about. So it's called The Publishing Rodeo. It's for people at that mid stage in their career who want to know a bit more about how agenting works, how marketing works. How
I might listen to that, because I can never work off the finances or the economics of the business. We are out of time, but I want you to briefly, with Open L to play a clip, tell us about your cultural buried treasure. Who is Mary Stuart?
Oh, Mary Stuart is wonderful. And thank you to my friend Jane Casey, the author, who brought her to my attention. And now I'm bringing her to everybody else's. She was a writer of thrillers based in the 1950s. She's British. She wrote this series of thrillers where there's always this young woman who is plunged into an adventure. She's a kind of a daring do, you know, a young woman who's very independent and very bright and is off in Crete or Corfu or somewhere really glamorous, and a mysterious thing happens and she has to go and solve the mysterious thing. They're great fun, but they're also beautifully written. They're all set in different European countries. So if you're on holidays in Greece, pick one up. But the sense of adventure and independence, it's just this female-centred thriller that is so entertaining, so enjoyable, but I think you can get a lot from today as well. And they're fairly widely available, so go check her out.
Sinead, you were brilliantly qualified for your former job as arts and culture correspondent at RT, and congratulations on the publication of your latest novel, A Maid on Fifth Avenue. Sinead Crowley, thank you so much for joining us for the Culture Club.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.